Welcome to New World Road, and we are talking about class conflict and the crisis of feudalism, and specifically chapter 18, which is feudalism are feudalité and seigneury in France and England, are feudalism versus seigneurism. I figured out how to translate that in English. Sirism.
Seniorism.
Because Spanglish gets the closest, apparently. But
I'm a seniorist.
And I'm going to warn our listeners, we are going into this particularly dour, even for us. We're not going to go into the conversation, but if our mood seems down, it's because it is.
If anybody has been on Twitter for the past week, you'll understand why the fuck we're just, you know.
So when this is released, so it'd be in the past month. It's been a
disheartening.
Yeah, every 4 years there's a period in left media spaces where I end up walking away and just saying, you know why there is no COINTELPRO anymore? Because we don't need it.
Yeah, because it would be redundant. That's the reason why.
Like why send feds in to like trick us into destroying ourselves when we could just do it on our own for free?
Right. So, I mean, we've internalized COINTELPRO infiltration tactics as good practice, you know? So they don't need to do anything at this point.
Yeah. You know my hot take on that, Chris, and we'll talk about this in our revolutionary pessimism episode, but that, like, I think COINTELPRO tactics actually were always redundant, and that was sort of the dark secret. And the few places that they weren't redundant, that's when there's actual violence. Like...
Okay.
I'll buy it. Well, I mean, like, for example, like how COINTELPRO messed with the RCP was just convincing members of the RCP to state their opinions. That was it. That's all they did.
Yeah.
Like, then eventually, when the RCP becomes more unified from all the splits that they accidentally encouraged, and they didn't even know they were encouraging the splits because they were already there. They send them that, you know, during one of their assaulting campaigns, they come into conflict with local cops, and the COINTELPRO people like give the cops intel, and the cops fuck up and shoot a kid, right? Yeah. Which the COINTELPRO people are immediately horrified by, because every time there's a murder like that of a white kid, then there's going to be like inquiries that can expose what they're doing.
Yeah.
So that's what I learned from reading all the declassified COINTELPRO stuff with the RCP. And when I read the rest of it, the only place it was significantly different was the Panthers, where there was a lot more violence. But there was a lot more violence because there's a lot more room for it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But that's not related to the Middle Ages. I mean, it kind of is. We can get into vassal lord stuff and knights and fucking shit up. So let me.
As everything is related to the Middle Ages.
Yeah. I try hard enough. We are on page 230.
Did we finish with 229? I think.
We stopped at the village community was more collective than.
The very last paragraph on the page 229.
Yeah. Right. Which is this whole, I think this gets us into the debates about peasantry in France, and why like Marxist generalizations from Marx about French conditions of the peasantry actually can't be transhistoricized, even though we try to do it all the time.
And we talked about how the peasant economy was an incomplete economy, and we talked about the commons. So I think maybe we are on 230 then.
Right. And because of the commons, it's a more communal life. The actual exception to that is post-feudal France. In Marx's Marx uses that as the model, although he's not his only model. He does actually note there's differences between like German peasants and French peasants and whatnot.
Yeah.
But the quotes that Marx makes about the peasantry in France are the quotes that people tend to derive as the transhistorical cases for how we should approach the peasantry.
Right. So. Yeah.
Yeah. And in this, I don't know if we'll get to all of it, but he tries to make some very clear distinctions between English and French feudalism. So the state of the peasantry in both places is completely different.
Yeah, and I think that's important. So let's get into that. All right. So, okay, I'm just going to start us off like I tend to do. I tend to be a line by lineist. Chris tends to be a big ideaist, and Jason seems to split the difference. So, Jason, you are the dialectical sublation here.
That's what I came here to do.
All right. So, in some parts of France, this is on page 230. Particularly New Paris and further east, some rural communes emerged as social and political entities with limited autonomy. In spite of the successes of the village communities, however, we must not see them as any more than we see the peasant holdings as essential, distinctive units of feudal society. Any gains made by rural communes were partial and not widespread. And it is rather to the
signory.
That lordship or manor that we should look. It was in this institution that the two great classes met face to face. The landowners, great and small, and the peasants, rich and poor, first to receive, second to give their labor or the fruits of their labor in cash or in kind. It was the principal theater that of that act of coercion sanctified by custom, legitimated juridically in various forms of dependence ranging from serfdom to villainage. By villainage we mean villainage to be made a outlaw, by which the infinitely scattered surpluses of the peasant economy were concentrated into the hands of the politically and socially dominant class. There's a whole lot in there. I mean, like in there, for example, we in that one paragraph we see things that would hint at the debates around whether or not debt or hard currency is super important to medieval societies, how you pay them, whether or not it was in currency a la chartalism or in kind, and turns out it was both, depending. So there's a lot of gesto stories about how we got the modern economy that David Graeber and other people have speculated on. That, I mean, weirdly, this chapter touches on, but I don't want to go too much down those rabbit holes, because I think it's actually really important that what he's saying is like, yeah, there were strong communes, they were even economically profitable, but the relationships of lord and the relationships of dependence and independence created by these taxations, and these taxations are not taxations of just like nominal currency, like the way we talk about it in modern economic trade, the way we think about, like, you know, if you're an MMT or like the reason why we tax is to get rid of inflation or whatever, like these are actually, no, the Lord needs your fucking labor and your stuff. Like this is not, they're not getting money to increase their power through money. They're accumulating goods for use values. And that's actually kind of important. At least they are here in France. And so we have to look at that class relation. Now, I think this is interesting from a Marxist standpoint, because whether or not you think relations of production are modes of production is actually a super big debate within Marxism. And it actually seems like Hilton is kind of coming down on relations without like stating it clearly. Mm-hmm. I think this is interesting. I think this is also interesting. The fief and the lordship eventually overlapped, and the asterisk is in the case of France. The fief was a piece of income yielding property held of a superior lord by a vassal who swore fealty, promised military services on horseback, financial aid, and advice. As a side note, interestingly, I learned today that Knecht in German means servant, and in English means knight, and it has something to do with this actual transition in continental relations. So,
We'll talk about this later. Never mind. I was going about thaneship in Anglo-Saxon England, but whatever. We'll talk about that. That's in this article later.
Yeah, it could be very small. Some English military tenants in the 12th century had fiefs and land, which were fractions of villages. I don't think until I read this text that it occurred to me that like villages were never fiefs, which I think I always thought they kind of were always in fiefs, but apparently they weren't. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, they could be
fractions of villages. This is definitely the first time I've ever encountered this either.
Well, I mean, and that's one of the things I mentioned last time, is kicking kicking the landlords out of Florence wasn't just kicking them physically out of Florence, but like divesting them of their property in Florence, you know, is actually a pretty revolutionary act.
So it's not just like literal kicking them out or even literal land reform. It's also like, and your property title holdings are gone.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Anything within the commune for sure. Yeah.
Right. Which I guess leads to a problem because, for example, there's one of the great debates about England and English quote land reform was that England didn't get it because the bourgeois revolution wasn't complete. But why they didn't get it was sometimes argued that they kind of got it by proxy, by indirect, you know, because of the way land was administered, that you kind of didn't need land reform in the same way. But I think this actually puts a lie to that as a claim, which is very interesting because for me, you know, when we're interested in this and understanding the history of Marxist historiography, for example, and Hilton's a Marxist, like if you're reading this super closely, you also read like he's not just like for him trying to settle scores on, you know, the historiography of the Middle Ages. He's also like for him clarifying obscure political commitments that it might actually emerge from some of this shit, I think.
Yeah.
Or at least if he isn't doing it actively, he's doing it accidentally. Like, anyway, blah, blah, blah. The concept of fief as part of a fund of landed property handed down through the feudal hierarchy in order to reward or retain the loyalty of warriors would seem to be well supported by the English evidence. But this is only one way of looking at the disposal of estates of conquered England. In France, however, many fiefs were family allodial property, the term of whose tenure was feudally redefined without the family losing its original endowment. The family's grip on the land was hardly weakened, the heredity of fiefs even in England, though briefly challenged, was never really in doubt. But as property bought and sold, subdivided and regrouped, the fief as a means of mobilizing military service became of little significance. That seems pretty important. Can you explain why it's important, Chris? Like,
well, because it's whenever you start switching away from the fief as the as the source of military, the way the king would build his military. And you start switching towards people paying cash to the king to fulfill their military duties. That's when you get the beginnings of the standing army. Of course, that doesn't come into play until much, much later. But you see the king starting to hire out mercenaries, right? And then they eventually figure out you could just have a standing army for cheaper than hiring out mercenaries. And actually, they build the state in order to be able to hire out mercenaries, or to first to hire out mercenaries, and then second to have a standing army. So it's part of the process of building the nation state.
Right, and I think it's crucial that we're looking at England and France here, and specifically that they're two very different cases. But you know, I've always put it: until you get the Treaty of Westphalia, your only real nation states, and I know this is a controversial claim, but it's one that I'm willing to stake up. Point on are England and France, which is why we always use them for everything, right? Mm-hmm. Like,
further east you go, the less clear it is for like a very long time, like up into the 20th century, even.
Right, like, and then you know you get into this weird stuff now where you know you have people like liberals will say, well, Germany is a new nation, but it's an ancient culture, and I'm like, but it isn't though. Like, unified Germany is a modern creation, and its cultural unification is modern. They just had a similar language. And even the language becoming the same is like a Bible thing. Like, it, you know, Lutheran German, I mean, is the unified.
Yeah, I mean, that's mostly true. I think Otto Bauer, he does do a bit of work to make the opposite case, although I don't exactly know how effective it is, because it's kind of been a while since I've read this stuff.
I mean, I think that like if you study German at all, you see the enormous differences in dialects that are like, I don't know, probably not too much different than say like Czech and Slovak are, and those are considered to be two different nations. I mean, are
national projects and languages are very clear because we have Chinese dialects, right? But those dialects are not mutual. They're not even mutually comprehensible. That's a political project. Yeah. Versus like certain families of Romance languages, for example, they're actually more mutually comprehensible.
Or like Yugoslav languages.
Exactly. Like, like Southern Slavic languages is like, you guys just don't want to admit you speak the same language because you use a different alphabet. Like,
Sometimes it's even the same alphabet. It's like the difference between Bosnian and Serbian is religious, and that's it.
I had a Serbian professor who's like, oh yeah, I always pad my resume. I used to pad my resume out by saying, oh, I speak Croatian and Bosnian and Serbian.
Which is true enough, but so the political context here, I think, is something we do have to keep in mind when we talk about this. And I think even Marxists have not been great about that in the past. Yeah. Let's go back to France. I just wanted to illustrate why this is important, right? Because if this change of say nested relations moves from what we could call private governance. And in some ways, I don't want to go all Hans Hermann Hoppe because I think he's wrong, but there is a sense in which early feudal relations is ironically private governance because the empires have fallen apart. And so what governs, like, yes, there is law. Yes, there's an emperor to enforce the law. But really, though, the laws are weird. There's multiple sources of law and there's multiple jurisdictional courts that overlap. And not in a way of like them being nested in each other. Like, no, you were just subject to different jurisdictional courts, some ecclesiastical, some secular, et cetera. With the exception of France and England, this is really fragmented till really the bourgeois revolutions. Now, France and England, though, you have this shift in relations, which seems to solidify a need for the state earlier than in other places, except for places that have strong empires, which again we don't talk about them because they're not nation states, but that already had similar relations, such as the various caliphates, the Byzantine, the Byzantine Roman Empire, various Chinese states, etc. So what we have here is like the idea that you would have a nation state versus an imperial state seems to actually be related in this shift of administering relations in France and in England, but they're different in France and England. Am I understanding what the argument being made here is?
I mean, I think so.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let us move on, because I think that's a key established point. Okay. I want to skip a little bit ahead because I'm not going to read everything. It is not only difficult, but perhaps mistaken task to compare feudal societies of medieval France and medieval England. Just like that line is like, so this thing we're doing, it's probably a bad idea.
And then he goes right back into it, doing the exact same thing.
Within the modern boundaries of the two countries, there were, in the Middle Ages, most striking regional diversities that each kingdom, there were greater contrast between some of the provinces of each. So the provinces are administered so differently that like maybe England and France share more than like Burgundy and
Lusitania,
Provence or whatever. Like, all right. England south of the Thames was more like Normandy than it was the Marches of Wales. The Isle de France was a lot more like the Valley of the Lower Thames than it was like Languedoc. But if there were three great regional diversities within each country, perhaps insofar we can arrive overall generalizing view of England and French society, the similarities will emerge more forcefully in that we recognize these internal diversities, not divergencies. So I guess what we are saying here is like, you know what? Yeah, it's impossible to do, but we're going to do it anyway because it's going to be clarifying, even though we realize that the internal to each of these countries, it's still highly diverse and kind of a mess.
I mean, this is what non-historic peoples, that whole discussion is all about, is like the ruling class has a shared culture of a general kind of, you know, there what's England and then over there what's France. but then the people underneath them, they don't really represent anything. They're just tenants of the nation.
And right. So, like,
and so Occitan. In some cases, like entire, what we would call today, we would recognize as peoples, just don't come into play into any of this. Like, for example, like Chris, like you just said, like Occitan, for example, they're just non-historic.
They're a different people than the French.
Yeah.
They speak a different language. In fact, that's where the Languedoc comes from, is in southern France, you would say oc instead of oui for yes. So they're the language where you say oc, you know, or whatever. I don't know. My French is not good. I didn't take enough of it to get any good at it. But so I mean, like, that the way that France became France was fucking through fire and sword.
Right. Which I think I want to talk about the historic peoples thing a little bit, because one of the things that Marxists get critiqued of is conflating the normative and descriptive, and whether or not that's true for Marxists, and maybe it is. It's definitely true for Hegel. Because Hegel really thinks that this is a truth process that brings us closer to God, and everyone who tries to secularize Hegel and leave that closer to God through negativity thing out, I don't think you can actually understand what Hegel is doing without that.
Well, and to be fair, like, most people don't understand Hegel.
That's true. But it's not a hard assumption to be like, oh no, he thinks that like history is leading us to God's kingdom. Like, it's an eschatological argument. I'm sorry, it is.
Yeah, like, and a lot of what he says is just to be taken literally. He just means exactly what he says, and that. And if you take it literally, it's not hard to understand at all.
Which, and the reason why I bring this up here, though, is that when we talk about historic peoples, like, Hegel thinks there's a reason why there are historic peoples.
Right,
whereas you and I would just think, well, they just won the fight on a given day. Like, it's a lot more arbitrary. It's not mere contingency, but it's still not as, well, it's not part of some master teleological plan in which the whole universe is playing at very specific subjects at certain times, which means secularizing that in Marxist language gets us into some weird problems, because how do we decide who's a historic people or not? Well, we can decide in the past, but we're also given to try to predict it in the now, and that usually does not go well.
Yeah, it's usually a bad thing.
I mean, just looking at, for example, when Marx or Engels tries to pick who's going to be progressive or not in a national liberation movement in the 1860s, is like, well, you called that wrong and that wrong and that wrong.
Guess what? They were wrong every once in a while.
Yeah. Well, I'm not, you know, I don't lose sleep over this. I think, but I my point is, I think, like, this is something that Marxist historians now, I think you're faced with the choice to either double down on the historic people's categorization or to throw it out. Like, you can't just kind of namby-pamby deal with it. You either have to, like, try to defend it in secular terms and thus try to come up with a way to make it predictive. Or you have to be like, well, this is some Hegelian baggage that doesn't help us. I don't know. Like, we can try to, like, square the circle. Maybe you guys will offer me a sublated way for me to read this, but I don't see one, because I get when we talk about historical peoples in the past, like, that makes total sense. Like, well, this group lost and they were subsumed into this group, like, and maybe not even like actually killed, because most of the case we've actually learned that people actually tend to not be super genocidal monsters and they're literally killing everyone with sense. I mean, we do it every now and then, but it's not a common thing.
I mean, I think it makes sense, but only when looking back in the past. Like, like, if you think about like Engels and his characterization of the Slavic people, the non-Polish Slavic people as non-historic, he's actually kind of right, but only as it relates to what has already happened. And then, you know, then Austria-Hungary, the empire that breaks apart, and then all of those individual cultures, they all start to assert themselves and start to really make their stamp on history, and they stop being non-historic. So it's just not a useful way to understand anything anymore.
Right. I mean, for me, it is only useful in hindsight. So removing, like I wouldn't remove it from talking about, like, well, we don't talk about Languedoc as like an origins of France because they're subsumed in the French culture, and you know, right. their differences are by hook, crook, fire and sword and Inquisition, literally erased. And you know, whereas there are cases that are harder though, like the Scottish. That's actually a hard call. Like,
it kind of is actually, yeah.
So you know, I just don't know how helpful it is to try to apply that into the future.
It's not helpful at all. And in as much as it was, it was less than helpful.
It's about as helpful as trying to decide where an owl is going to land after dark, but during the daytime.
Yeah. Unless
you're an owl scientist.
Developing an app to like track owls.
I mean, we probably could figure it out probabilistically, but there's still that 1% chance. Anyway, not going to get into this. My favorite thing is when people get mad. We're like, oh, you predicted it wrong. And I was like, I gave it a 30% chance of happening. Do you have any idea how big of a percentage chance of something happening 30% actually is? Like,
I mean, that's one of my favorite things that people do on the internet is get mad at you for predicting things wrong. They're like, dude, I was fucking guessing. What the fuck?
I never claimed to be correct on this. I was trying to like read tea leaves like the rest of you dumb motherfuckers. Like, I don't know.
The difference between me and you is that I said it on the internet and you didn't, you know?
Oh, man. I hold me accountable when I try to theorize my predictions and come up with a system for it. Then I think it's fair to call me out. But if I'm just like, I don't know, I think this might happen. Good luck. Okay. So on this, though, I think this is interesting. I'm going to read this paragraph because I think it's also going to be helpful. To English historians, the difference at first seemed considerable. The most obvious, partly in our minds, as a result of preoccupation with the 19th and early 20th century historians with the emergence of the centralized state in the form of the feudal monarchies, is that the English aristocracy never managed to complement their undoubted powers as landowners and lords of tenants with corresponding jurisdictional and political power. This seems huge, actually. And this seems actually part of why capitalism may have developed in England, in all seriousness. The lesson that we learned about France is that following the disintegration of the ramshackle and relatively short-lived power of the Carolingian emperors, God, that's a slam on the Carolingians. The great provincial is like the Carolingians. You know that super big empire that we're always like beating on about how awesome Charlemagne is? Well, they sucked. Like, they couldn't even like stay together for very long.
Ramshackle power is very That's definitely a called out. Yeah,
take that, Charlemagne. The great provincial landholders, the potentes, openly appropriated the public jurisdiction that they held as dukes and counts by imperial nomination. The aristocratic families of the region, tied by vassalage and increasingly by tenure, and their allots were turned into fiefs, to the dukes and counts themselves underwent an important evolution. Family allegiances with the rise of lateral links between agnate and cognate connections consolidated themselves into lineages more concerned with direct ancestry and descendants than with collaterals, and focused more on the male rather than on the female line of descent. This concentrated and consolidated lineages and established firm bases of local power, usually focused on castles, like actual physical things, guys. They too appropriated the public jurisdictions whose boundaries nearer than the country were defined by an area of domination of the castle. Finally, their vassal, the knights of the villages, consolidated their local power as landowners with various levels of public jurisdiction, and they too turned their tenants into subjects as they themselves climbed into the ranks of the nobility. Interestingly, this is just me talking. I thought this is what happened in England, and I was apparently wrong. So, like, this is what I was taught happened in feudal societies in general. So,
yeah, that's same. That's because, I mean, that's what these historians that say feudalism didn't exist are tilting against, is the idea that you can apply one single, very rigid description of feudalism to everywhere in Europe.
Yeah, which is fair enough. Like,
yes,
true.
It is.
Like, friend of the show, enemy of Marxism, Colin Jerome. also makes the same point. And although I think he takes it to the point that he thinks we should reject historical distinct, like historiographic periods altogether. So,
yeah, I don't know how useful that is.
Yeah, you know that's a common argument these days. Though that's not just Colin. I've heard it a lot in academia that we just need to like that these distinctions lead us to false differences. And I'm like, I don't know, man. There really is a very different way the economy works between the 14th and the 18th century. Sorry, why?
Yeah,
like
or between the 18th and the 20th, or
right?
You know, I mean,
yeah, I mean, go ahead.
I feel like you know, there's a tendency, especially I don't know what to call it exactly, but let's just say in intellectual discourse, whatever that means, over the last few decades, to like collapse as many categories as possible in order to streamline, make things simpler. But I don't think it does. I think it, in every case, I think it actually makes things less clear and more confusing. Like, yes, it's true that the category is not exactly 100% applicable the further out you zoom. But if you just delete the category altogether, then nothing is distinguishable at all. And also, that just happens to be exactly, even formally, the actual logic of postmodernism. Yeah. The ever-present present, yeah.
Well, it's the map and the territory problem. So, okay, you have an accuracy problem on your map. Well, let's just, you know, get more accurate with the map and drop the artificial distinctions. Well, you know what eventually happens? It becomes not useful because the map is basically just a picture of the fucking planet undistinguished with no clarifying cat. Like, that's what happens.
Yeah.
Like, and it's weird that, like, what is interesting to me is over the 20th century, the opposite tendency happens everywhere but historiography and history. Like, we get more obsessed with categories everywhere else. But in history, we're just like, oh, no, categories bad. Like it's just, categories aren't real. Like, no shit. Whoever thought they were real? Like, they describe real things. They're not real in of themselves. Like,
yeah. Unless,
who's a historical Platonist?
Like, yeah, they're only real if they're enforced. Like, I've had a friend that once said, the difference between a language and a dialect is who has a better army. And that's kind of true.
Yeah. The difference between a religion and an idea set is did a Christian emperor declare it? Anyway,
yeah.
All right. So we have this model where like in England the aristocracy is really only able to develop rentier power, right? For whatever reason. Like, they don't actually have the same jurisdictional power. And when I think about that, I guess that does ring true to me because I don't think of, like, strong jurisdictional ways to fight, like, the nobility in England after, like, the 13th century. It just doesn't seem to exist. Like, even before the Reformation and whatnot. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but that seems to, you know, that does seem to be what Hilton is indicating here, right? Like that, like in England proper, like the lords had a shit ton of economic power, but they really weren't that like politically or militarily powerful as warlords separately from the Norman state. Like it just doesn't seem to be the case.
Yeah. In fact, actually, whenever they became that kind of powerful, they became a problem for the actual power.
Right. Whereas, like, Right. Whereas the whole system in France, like, seems to be dependent on these people being actual military powers with actual, you know, internally consistent standing armies, et cetera. But Chris, what's your take? This is actually your specialty, not mine.
Yeah, definitely not mine.
Well, I mean, and Hilton gets into this later on in the article. But yeah, you are right. The Norman state is much more powerful than the French state. But he talks about how later on, how it sort of starts to delegate more judicial power, you know, actual local power over life and death and everything else, including military, not including military, down to the local levels.
So common law becomes more and more important than just yes. Like Lord's decree, right? Because the common law is like the automation. I hate to use this word because it's confusing to people. It's like the automation of the Lord's will because the good courts are protected by the king, not the lords, the kings. The king's will, because the good courts are protected by the kings, is we can trust the court judgment. So the court itself, the actual medieval court, doesn't have to travel around our little island. It can just stay in London all the time. And we can trust the administrators to be the court in lieu of the court or the actual courtiers. And and that is kind of weird, actually, to think about. I mean, it's even kind of hidden in the words. Just... Anyway, and I don't think that would have been possible in Anglo-Saxon.
Well, the originally after 1066, you had traveling jurists, like traveling right. judges that went around. But if it, that toward later on, it really starts, the power starts to devolve to local landlords. So yeah, the emphasis on the common law becomes really important.
Okay. Blah blah blah. The Norman invaders, destroying their old English aristocracy, took the institutions of the English monarchy, and from this firm base, in the next two centuries, successfully excluded individual magnates, except for the lords of the western and northern marches, from developing a baron, a baronical or baronal jurisdiction, founding on alienated public powers, comparable to that opposite number in France. The haute justice in England by the end of the 13th century was dealt out by royal justices of a size, as were most disputes concerned with land held in the freehold, including military tenure. The old franchises, whereby jurisdiction at the level of the hundred court was in private hands, were seemingly denatured in that instead of being an appropriation of public power by private lord had been appropriated by the agent of the public power. Okay. What does that mean, Chris? I kind of read that sentence like 50 times when I encountered it the first time.
It does sound very important, but what does it mean?
Hold on. Let me read it again. I was distracted.
I tripped over the number of legal words that I hadn't seen in like 10 years. Cause I don't read legal documents anymore.
Hold on. What section are we on? I got an email from a student. I was answering it and I wasn't paying attention.
232, Chris. 232. The hot justice in England by the end of the 13th century was dealt out by royal justices of a size, which I think you mentioned.
Yes.
As were most disputes concerned with land held in the freehold, including the military tenure. The old franchises, whereby jurisdiction at the level of the hundred court were held in private hands, were seemingly denatured. In that instead of this being an appropriation of public power by private land, by a private lord, the private lord had been appropriated as an agent by the public power. What's the difference between that distinction at the end? That's what I'm struggling with.
Okay. So rather than sort of in the old French method of the lord essentially having complete jurisdiction over all of his own land, everything that happens within his own land, and it being affiliated to the king through an oath of fealty, right? This is essentially power delegated downwards. Ultimately, it's still the king's power, but you are exercising the king's power through the complicated legal system of the English state. The Norman
state. Yeah, right. So basically, okay, you get your power back, Lord, but you don't hold this as a franchise where it's your power. Really, your power is my power, motherfucker. Like, is that what I'm seeing here?
Yeah, really? Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, it's like the slow evolution towards centralized power and the forming of the nation state. You know, it happens within the 13th century.
Right. So instead of Lord as the Lord's prerogative, it's Lord as functionary of the king.
Yeah. Which is kind of like what the Carolingian state was trying to do, right?
But and failed.
What the Byzantine state actually did for the most part.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the Byzantine state was an empire. So basically what you have then is the Norman state is able to do internal imperialism better than the French state is.
Yes.
Got it. Okay.
The Norman system, as I mentioned last time, is the most, I think, the strongest of the feudal systems.
Yeah, with the strongest central court. And okay, there's a good reason for not carrying this contrast to extremes. First, there's the question of scale. England at the end of the 13th century was a feudal kingdom of about 4 million people at a comparably small area of land, mostly concentrated to the southeast of the line from Exeter to York. France was a country of 15 million people, evidently distributed with variable densities, but with an extreme south by no means lagging behind the Paris region. From the Norman coast to the Mediterranean is about 600 miles, and from Bordeaux to Lyon is 350 miles. Secondly, there's a question of distribution of aristocratic landed properties. In England, in contrast to France, the greater magnates tended to have property scattered rather than concentrated in one region. That seems important, actually.
Yeah, that's actually part of the reason for the French Revolution, is the like utter incoherence and scattered nature of everything. So that like you live in one area and you're going to bring some goods to another area and you have to pay a tax like four times instead of just once. Stuff like that is even the reason why they understood themselves to be abolishing feudalism, regardless of what actually happened, you know?
Yeah.
Wait, did you say the French?
Yeah.
And the English was
way more
scattered and decentralized than the English would, if you were awarded land, you wouldn't necessarily be awarded land adjacent to your land. So if it comes to raising an army against, you know, your lord or whatever, you can't necessarily have a base of territory that's all contiguous. You know, some of your land might be in the middle of your enemy's land.
Right. Right. So what I think you're getting at to late, Jason, is late French.
Yeah.
Like jurisdictional, everybody has all these different rights of taxes overlapping. And that doesn't happen in England. There's basically one landholding tax. But England, the English king and state eventually make sure that it remains most powerful by like saying like, yeah, you can have a bunch of lands, but I'll just give the example here. The Clare Earls of Gloucester, for example, had the most important concentration of property in East Anglia, the West Midlands, and South Wales. So like, good luck raising a consistent army when your land holdings are spread out across the country with peoples who don't even necessarily speak the same language.
Right. Like, yeah. Yeah.
In post-Carolingian Gaul, the collapse of authority of the state simply revealed the real power was and could only be exerted in an area which was not too big for a duke or a count to rule with the aid of his followings. So they maintain clear, contiguous land holdings.
Right.
In contrast, in spite of the difficulties of travel, low-lying England, where the population was concentrated, was small enough to be handled by royal administration, eventually settled in Westminster. Furthermore, the disposal of property and consequently of the followings and allegiances meant that except for Wales and the Welsh and Scottish marshes, it was more realistic for a higher nobility to exercise power through the influence of the king's court than to rely on regional strength. And their local followings had an important power base for the sake of leverage at the center. So geography actually really matters here.
Yes. Like,
and how the geography is maintained.
It's those material conditions, man.
Yeah, material conditions actually mean stuff, and they also mean stuff other than just like whether or not you have a factory. All right,
which is why you can't just say geographic determinism is bullshit. It doesn't mean anything. Which I can't believe that people actually do. It's always blown my mind. I've never understood that.
No, I'm not a geographic determinist in like the way that say 19th century Germans tend to be. No. Where I think like geography determines your personality, but
like the folkish nationalists that you, we're from a place where we have moist soil, so we're more romantic. But if you're from an area with dry soil, it means you're going to be greedier.
Yeah. Which by the way, I mean, it's not that Marx and Engels weren't given to that stuff sometimes themselves.
It's not like that stuff is based on nothing. It's just, it's taken way too far, you know?
Right. But I do think like, hey, looking at like the fact that geography actually does kind of, and how you administer that geography. So it's not just like, oh, the rocks are this way, this is how this is going to be, really does affect the way power can concentrate or not. And the reason why I bring this up is if you think it matters here, when David Graeber goes in his Dawn of Everything book with David Wingrove goes, well, if we just think a different way, other things were possible. And I'm like, yeah, but have you looked at like the conditions of the societies that had egalitarian relations or like in certain places with certain conditions? And maybe if we, I don't know, learn what those conditions are, we can mimic them as opposed to just like saying believing shit is possible because because, you know, if we believe it, we can make it happen. If you build it, they'll come. Like,
it's like a Reading Rainbow lesson.
Yeah, it just seems to me like, yeah, I mean, like, people have, like, there's obviously human will into why, for example, England has a strong state versus France's relatively weak one, and why when France attempts to build a strong state in the early modern period, it's like a ridiculous overclaim. You know, that's why, like, French absolutism is so absolute. It's actually because their state priorly was so weak. So it's just like, whereas, like, the English don't need absolutism. Their central state is strong. We can have, like, proto-bourgeois liberty because we have a strong central state. Fuck you. Like,
in fact, the most absolutist state that exists, I think, is England, but not through the king, through parliament. Parliament has absolute authority, which is a semi-democratic institution. And so it's like you bypass the problems of absolutism in doing that.
That's the thing about making a revolution first, is like, it's not nearly as complete as the ones that come later.
No, it's not.
We're actually going to be talking about the Jeff Ely article or book about the incomplete German bourgeois revolution pretty soon.
Well, I mean, one of the things I like to point out when people talked about incomplete bourgeois revolutions in the 19th century, it wasn't a metaphor.
No,
it wasn't it wasn't even just about rights. It's like, no, literally, like, there's fucking still a feudal aristocratic basis to the state. Like, literally.
Yeah. Claim is that Bismarck is actually a Bonaparte figure and does a top down bourgeois revolution.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It gets us into our progressive Bonapartism versus regressive Bonapartism debate. Yeah. We're going to skip that because that's not going to help us understand the Middle Ages.
No, it's not. Right. That was just a teaser.
It's a teaser into Varn having a heart attack about if we're ever going to finish this paragraph, which I am also the worst offender of. All right. So that we are. All right. We finally got to page 32,
33.
All right.
233. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. The principal characteristics from the standpoint of the relations of lords and peasants was that the peasant holding provided rent consisting of unpaid and enforced labor services for the cultivation of the demesne and for the manufacture of craft products needed in the estate. The rent, mostly labor services, take that, money people, was to some extent in kind, was a payment to the lord in his capacity as the landowner and was notionally related to the size of the holding. From the 10th century to the, and we're talking about France here for people, so I didn't say that. From the 10th century or even the late 9th century, as populations grew, and coincidentally, of course, with social political decentralization to which we have already referred, peasant family holdings disintegrated and were reformed, demesne cultivation dwindled, and labor rent was largely replaced by money rent, which tended to become fixed by custom and devalued. But since this was precisely the time when the lords, high and low, were appropriating public jurisdictions, including the power of command, that is to say, ban, over all persons within their jurisdictional area, the opportunity arose to organize a transfer of peasant surplus in forms of varied jurisdictional profits, court fines, payments of the uses of the lord's mill, oven and wine presses, corvées unrelated to the tenure but consequent to the general power of command. In a word, by the 11th century, Signore Dominale, I don't know, was succeeded by Signore Benile. That's funny. Counts, Castilians, and knights were not merely landholders with tenants, but sovereigns with subjects. And the whole movement was inseparable with the growth of the urban markets, great and small, and with the conversion of serfdom into villainages, which might be considered a change of terminology rather than substance. I'm going to leave that last bit. So I think that's what we see there is, like, the reason why France doesn't have a and the reason why I actually think why French national consolidation is even more violent than English, which I think we need to know because it is. is because, like, basically the Lords by necessity had to become many little states of administration, mm-hmm. and they had basically sovereign exception within their domains, because their domains were contiguous, etc., and because the onerous nature of the rent system in France actually collapsed the peasant holdings in a way that had them backdoor change their economy through legal fiat.
Yeah.
Right. Which seems kind of important. Whereas England didn't do that. at least in the Doomsday Book time. Right. Though seldom reaching the high proportions of demesne to the tenures found an example in the state of Saint-Germain de Paris, de Prés, or Saint-Breton in the Carolingian period, the organizing principle of aristocratic random property at the time of the Doomsday Book and in the 12th century surveys with the cultivation of the demesne by labor services owned from dependent tenures, usually realized economically in the payment of fixed annual farm and money or kind. After a marginal concentration of demesne in the 12th century, the whole system had remained virtually intact, not merely since 1086, but since at least the 10th century, was rejuvenated and expanded under the inflationary conditions of the 13th century. Demesne management... No, I just lost my foot. Demesne management was made accountable, managers replaced farmers, labor services were increased, and rents were raised. It's the opposite of France. Dependent villages, which have not been regarded as servile, were declared unfree in the public courts. Manorial profits rose, and the proportion of income from the sale of demesne produce sometimes exceeded the income from rent. So we had the beginnings of a market system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's actually really important. The domination system did not collapse in England until the second half of the 14th century. And it was almost as if England were three centuries behind France in feudal development, conserving large-scale demesne estate management and mainly loan earners, tenant relationships within the polity where the monarchy was strong and private jurisdiction in the hands of landowners being little more than regulatory, customary laws of the landed estate. In fact, the contrast is misleading. We will leave aside the question of the relative strengths of the Capian and Plantagenet monarchies only to deal with the minor estate and lordship. Here, the similarities are considerable, though through our perception of these similarities does not come easily because of the differences in nomenclature and historical traditions have emphasized contrast. But once those comparisons made, aspects of the country's history are thrown into relief by examining those of the other. Yeah. All right. Do we want to go into the next paragraph before we stop today, or do you want to stop here?
What are we at?
We're at
almost 30, an hour.
Yeah, we're about almost an hour, and we're at 34. So for our listeners, are we gonna? I'm afraid. My fear, dear co-host and listeners, is that this next argument's long. I'm not sure though. I can't remember. So,
well, we. I mean, there are two pages left in the entire chapter.
Yeah, but we could take us
four.
Yeah.
Right? Oh. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Never mind.
There are two pages left in the entire chapter, but each one of these paragraphs could take us 10 minutes to parse.
Yeah. Yeah, they are kind of long paragraphs, and they do kind of cover a lot.
And I have to check and make sure I understand them because they actually use very technical language, even for me. So.
Yeah. So one of the things that I think that we talk about. Villeinage versus serfdom,
right?
For classical medieval scholarship, there's like a differentiation between the two. Like medieval, like classical serfdom, is different than villeinage. But like, uh-huh. I think what Hilton is trying to say is it's a change in terminology, and there's no actual difference, especially because of the variation at which the system is applied. So he kind of uses villeinage and serfdom interchangeably, which as a Marxist, he would, right? Because I think ultimately the thing that is most important to us is the relationship to the means of production in this, or actually the social relations as well. But like the nitpicky details of how those social arrangements are arranged is not super important for our purposes.
So, what are we drawing from this so far? I mean, we're going to be spending a lot of time in the Hilton book, but I think what we're learning from, what I'm learning is law and geography are, and I know law is going to be the claim that people are going to really get up in arms about, are material conditions. I know I talk about this all the time, but it's actually kind of important. Like, and that over time, these develop with certain logics that really do make pretty significant differences in how like a state is administered, how power works, and how much individual power one can have, which also means, for example, the relative violence of trying to centralize that state is going to be different. And one thing I will point out is like, yeah, England's incorporation of its marshlands and whatnot, yeah, was pretty bloody, like, which is something that Hilton actually hints at here. So like Wales and Scotland are difficult because they're both culturally different, but they're also like geographically problematic. Whereas France is just like for the crown to assert itself over these lords is going to take breaking a lot of these lords, because their power in England is actually directly through the crown. Whereas their power here, it's kind of like, even though technically they're servile to the crown, or not mm-hmm. servile, but bonded to the crown. They're barely actually bonded to the crown. They have their own contiguous land holdings. The whole rent farming system isn't even how they make money anymore. And they can raise their own armies and enforce their own law, which actually does make sense to me, because one of the things I've always tried to figure out is like, why is English common law so much more coherent than all these other forms of law, which have to be standardized later on, either like through Napoleonic reforms or Justinian codes or whatever. And this actually gives me a reason why that happened.
Yeah.
It gives me an explanation for that I have not had, and is not, you know, like that used to be like, why is English common law so powerful? Like,
what's super interesting to me is that England, the existence of England, the Kingdom of England, is a direct result of the decentralized nature of French feudalism, because it was the Duchy of Normandy, right, that takes over England.
And yeah, that's right. Yeah,
the Duke of Normandy becomes the King of England, who is nominally subject to the King of France, but since he's more powerful than the King of France, because his system is more centralized, even though the King of France has. He individually is more powerful than the King of France on paper. Like,
right.
Even though the King of France has all of his retainers or anything, which is the cause of the Hundred Years' War, which we're going to get into next time.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense when you're like, okay, so England technically should be a French holding ran by a baronial lord who just happens to also be the accidental king of this other nation, right? Yeah. Like the English claim to kingship is actually not through the French system. It's through the fact that they have a tenuous holding on the Anglo-Saxon system, but they bring this this particular administration within the French system into the English state and makes them stronger.
Yeah.
And that's what that also indicates how varied they are, because like, it's not like the Burgundians or whatever could do this, because the different administrations are different. So like the way that the Normans are administering their state makes it stronger than even other baronial states, because that means that diversity between the two within France now makes sense for why it has an effect. Because like, let's say it was the Burgundians who got England for some reason, like, I don't know how they had a claim, but let's just say they did. How would this look different? Like, or whatever, like it might not, but I suspect it would.
I think it probably would in like most ways.
Yeah.
I think England might be France, is what I think like would happen. Like,
the Norman system, wherever it's exported, creates very interesting situations, like the Kingdom of Two Sicilies for one,
right?
The Kingdom of Jerusalem for another. If you want to go with the traditional history, like what about the Kievan Rus, right? Supposedly they call it what they call the Norman theory, right? But that's technically not Normans; that's Vikings, but you know.
Yeah, they're Northmen, though.
Northmen, right? Like, but they call it the Norman theory, which is why Ukraine is they're all Norse defending us against the hordes of barbarian Slavs, right?
That's true, yeah, because
Asiatic Slavs in particular.
Asiatic Slavs, the worst kind.
As opposed to those good Norse Slavs.
Those good Norse-mingled Slavs.
Yeah, because everybody on the western side of the collapse of the Soviet Union is actually a descendant of the feudal aristocracy from before the Romanovs.
Yeah, dude, they're all Rurikid, all of us.
All of them. Yeah. Instead of how they were almost all peasants and much, much lower than anyone, in fact, they all were aristocrats.
Yeah,
I don't know if anyone's actually saying that.
Well, they do say to make it like on the blood claims. I mean, you know, I don't know.
Oh, yeah, I know.
The thing is, like, even if they're not saying that, that's what they're saying.
Yeah. I'm proud to be of a weird Asiatic descent myself. So,
you're a Bulgarian ancestry, on right?
Yeah, Bulgarian Jew. Bulgarian Jew and Scottish, So, but I am married into like native Bulgarians. It's not just Sephards. So, like, but so Sephardic Jew and Bulgarians, and then Scotch Irish. So, like, but yeah, I have questionable North African Asiatic content. I used to like hope that it turned out that I was secretly a Khazar. That'd have been cool.
Way cooler. Instead,
it doesn't seem to have been the case. But
it should. DNA testing ruins everything. Like, we figured out that we're way more German than we thought we were.
Well, it ruins everything, or it's weird race science, which is, you know, like...
Yeah, that's true. It is weird race science, and we don't have to take it seriously, which means we're not German at all. We're just Czech.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that you can just reject it because it's weird race science.
Yeah. Like,
in favor of my own, like, race science... that I don't actually like fucking adhere to because race science is bad.
So you believe that speaking Czech gives you mystical powers? Is that
absolutely, like, yes, it like, does.
You should chew Slav. Like,
eating kolache makes you gives you mystical powers. Yeah, that's what it is.
You're gonna have to because kolache versus kulaches, which is what we get here, because I only get Czech cuisine as interpreted by Texans.
So, the kolache, as a Texan would refer to it, the kolache or a kolache, right?
Yeah, the kolache or the kulache is what it's how it gets. By the time it gets to Utah,
is it the one that has like sausage in it?
Yeah, they have those two. Some of them will be like stuff with like southwestern egg.
So that
they claim it's Texas Czech hybrid fusion food, which I think is fair. Actually,
yeah, that would be what Texas Czechs would call a klobasnik.
Okay,
which would anything that has like savory food, a klobasnik, klobasa is a sausage, right? So a klobasnik is a sausage kolache, but a kolache has fruit, or farmer's cheese or something like that in it, or cream cheese, whatever,
and relatively sweeter dough also.
Yeah, sweeter dough as well. Yeah,
I mean,
fluffier. Yeah. In Texas, it's fluffier. You go to Czech Republic, it's not as fluffy.
This is why I believe that cultural appropriation is good, because I think Texas Slavic food is a God's gift to humanity. Even though I would agree with that. I do eat eggs, though. So
I also think cultural appropriation is
just not real. It never happened. There never actually was cultural appropriation.
That's why Tejano music and Norteño music exist, is from Mexicans in South Texas and Northern Mexico, playing the same music as Czechs and Germans. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's awesome that happened.
And Scotch Irish. So you get the Czech German squeezy box and the Scotch Irish country music sound, and then you add all your Spanish indigenous like singing over it, and you get Tejano, Norteño, and Corrida. Corridas. I admit Corrida's funny, because when I'm like, that's the gangster music, it has polka beats. Okay. I'm not insulting any cartels with this statement.
This is a real good way to end the episode, is to just go off on the most insane tangent we could.
Yeah.